Thank you. I guess I should make some disclaimers at the outset. I may touch upon sacramental architecture, but not at length, but I would be happy to answer questions about sacramental architecture as offering and presence and allude to it a little bit throughout. Also, I realize listening to the introduction that I, if I write another book, I need a shorter second title. good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. It's Saturday in Manhattan, and I want to begin with confession. I am not an expert on Notre Dame de Paris, and I must confess as well that I always experience a certain frisson when I contemplate how Parisians mispronounce Notre Dame. So apart from the basics of its Christian narrative, I can't speak with authority about the iconography of Notre Dame, its exterior ranks of biblical figures, the theology of light it embodies, or its relationship to Neoplatonist traditions of thought, Dionysius the Areopagite, and medieval cults of the Virgin Mary. All things that I know primarily as hearsay, though Stephen's talk has reminded me of the many complex rumors associated with Saint-Denis, which I enjoyed being reminded of very much. There are two things when I set out to actually write what I intended to write. One of the topics was the purpose of sacred architecture, and the other was the nature of beauty. Actually, I talk a little bit more later about the nature of beauty. But the purpose of sacred architecture, I realized I didn't really get to. So I wanted to read two things before I go into the main body of the text, which first has to do with the conviction that sacred architecture is always a response to the sacred, that in its origins it is a response to the sacred. And it's a response to sacred presence, and it's a response that is dictated by a certain experience of a certain kind of religious experience. So there's any number of these kinds of experiences, obviously in biblical religion, in other religions as well. But I want to read what I regard as the paradigm, or certainly a paradigm, of religious experience, in part because it's first person and because it in a very short way sort of summarizes what the experience, the kind of the classical phenomenological religious experience is of Rudolf Otto described, of creature consciousness, of a feeling of submission, of a feeling of fear, which was brought up in Margaret's talk, and then a call and a response. So this is from the sixth chapter of the book of Isaiah, verses 1-8. And I'm sure you're all familiar with, probably you're all familiar with the story, and I'm sure you're familiar if you go to Mass, at least with some of the language. So in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. So this is a specific historic first-person event. And the Lord's train filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then flew one of the seraphim to me, having in his hand a burning coal, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin forgiven." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I, send me." So I want to read that to sort of for you to keep in the back of your consciousness. If we talk a little bit later about the nature of sacred space and encounters with the sacred. The second has to do with a definition or a characterization of the purpose of sacred architecture, which again I didn't get to. But one of the privileges of my of my academic position is that I direct thesis projects now and then, and I get students who want to do church buildings, and the students have to do a thesis statement as they proceed in the course of their thesis project. And so I had one last semester who, a smart guy, very diligent guy, we sort of worked on his definition of what his thesis was. And I kind of kept hammering him because he was, as often happens, giving a definition that was kind of subjective and therapeutic and, you know, sort of very subjective decisions about design decisions. And I was trying to get him to be, you know, to sharpen that definition. And then the other thing in our conversations is that what I was suggesting to him was informed by Joseph Ratzinger in 1985, who said in the course of an interview, made the comment to the interviewer that he regarded sanctity and art as more important than doctrine, as gateways to know God. And it's not, obviously he's a theologian. He's not saying that doctrine isn't important. He's not saying that truth is not important. It's that the kind of unity that we understand between the Christians understand in terms of truth, goodness, and beauty, that for most people, goodness and beauty are a better introduction to the Lord and to coming to understanding the truth. So this was the definition that he finally came up with, and again, so I throw it out there, and again, something we can talk about if we want. This is his thesis statement: sacred buildings are communal statements of faith that invite both congregants and civil society to acknowledge and worship God. When such buildings are durable and beautiful and shape and ornament the public realm, they make the truth claims of the faith community more believable. So, as I began, there's a lot I don't know about Notre Dame de Paris, but I do know, along with most, if not all of you, that Notre Dame, it's going to be hard for me, is an ancient, beautiful, and beloved Christian sacred building, and that from the recent April fire is now endangered by the kind of building culture we have become. So I want to talk this afternoon far too briefly and far too broadly about the difference between ourselves and the culture that built Notre Dame over the course of several centuries in terms of three distinctive ideal types, three distinctive ideal type cultures of building. First, pre-modern cultures of building, and I say pre-modern cultures in the plural, that produced walkable mixed-use urban settlements and understood certain buildings and sometimes cities themselves as microcosms of a larger cosmic and sacred order, an understanding of both the act and the products of building implicitly and sometimes explicitly sacramental. Second, the modern culture of building, singular, that began to arise in late 18th and early 19th century centers of the Industrial Revolution before really taking off in the 20th century as architectural modernism. Third, our current postmodern culture of building, characterized by Rem Koolhaas as Manhattanism in his 1978 retroactive manifesto Delirious New York, which is a truly remarkable book. Whatever you think of Rem Koolhaas, Delirious New York is a remarkable book. But a phenomenon, right, postmodern culture, really, a phenomenon that I'm going to characterize here as hypermodernism, which I contend is the built form of today's global cities and global economy. So I'm going to further describe these conditions in reverse chronological order, working backwards, as it were. And I suppose I should say at the outset that I think modernity has brought with it certain distinctive blessings and benefits, and also that I think there are some meritorious modernist buildings. Nevertheless, I do regard the building culture that has emerged today, the built environment we produce, as opposed to the older buildings and neighborhoods we simply consume, I regard our contemporary culture of building to be a social and environmental and aesthetic catastrophe. So let me begin with what would probably be a controversial proposition among architects, namely that architectural modernism is not a continuous development from the early 20th century to the present day that was for a short time interrupted by the architecture of the 1970s and 1980s. This supposed two-decade interruption of modernism was a stylistic peculiarity still known among architects as architectural postmodernism, or POMO, and is regarded by architects almost everywhere as a stylistic hiccup in the development of modernism. But I propose this alternative reading, that modernism itself is the hiccup that separates the pre-modern building culture of our past from our present postmodern condition that I'm here calling hypermodernism. Or, to say this more accurately, 20th century architectural modernism is the transitional phenomenon that brought us from our pre-modern understanding of architecture and urbanism to our current hyper-modern understanding of architecture and urbanism. Allow me to elaborate, moving, as I say, from the present back to a past that includes buildings such as Notre Dame de Paris. Here's my thesis. Hypermodernism is modernism shorn of modernism's confident consensus and moral and rationalist agenda. To put this another way, a Nietzschean way, hypermodernism is modernism unmasked. Hypermodernism is subjectivism, relativism, and individualism expressed in and at the scale of buildings and cities. Moreover, hypermodernism is the architecture of the global economy, taking as utilitarian premises certain modern material conditions and construction practices and the aesthetic possibilities that follow from them. We see this, for example, in the way hypermodernist architects employ, with little if any fanfare, the standard modern constructional practice of differentiating a building's structure, what holds it up, from its enclosure, what keeps the wind out, or the rain. Well, not always the rain. which means, I should follow my own script, which means separating what holds the building up from the exterior building skin attached to it. That sounds more neutral. This practice makes buildings, this practice of differentiating between structure and enclosure, makes buildings inherently less durable, but today is simply a taken-for-granted assumption of the modern construction industry, which privileges speed of construction and short-term economies of means. I hope I'm on the right number here. When the technologies that made this way of building possible were new, the modernists made it part of their ideological agenda, as in Le Corbusier's 5 points of the new architecture, shown here. But hypermodernists simply presume as conventions what for modernists was part of the modernist utopian agenda. And although the hypermodernist agenda does not include promoting, although the hypermodernist agenda does include promoting new technologies, these new technologies are embraced not in service to any utopian ideal, but rather for the sake of formal experimentation and, above all, novelty. Proclaiming in 1995 the death of both pre-modernist and modernist urbanism, and also mocking the Congress for the New Urbanism, the Dutch hypermodernist Rem Koolhaas wrote that, quote, "If there is to be a new urbanism, it will be the staging of uncertainty. To survive, urbanism will have to imagine a new newness. Urbanism redefined as a way of operating on the inevitable will attack architecture, invade its trenches, drive it from its bastions, undermine its certainties, explode its limits, ridicule its preoccupations with matter and substance, destroy its traditions, smoke out its practitioners." Whew. The seeming failure of the urban offers an exceptional opportunity, a pretext for Nietzschean frivolity. We have to imagine 1,001 other concepts of city. We have to take insane risks. We have to dare to be utterly uncritical. We have to swallow deeply and bestow forgiveness left and right. The certainty of failure has to be our laughing gas and oxygen. Modernization, our most potent drug. Since we are not responsible, we have to become irresponsible. in a landscape of increasing expediency and impermanence, urbanism can lighten up, become a gay science. That is, light urbanism. End quote. So this is the hypermodernist answer to such disillusioned modernists as the estimable late sociologist Nathan Glaser, who in his 2008 book, From a Cause to a Style, Modern Architecture's Encounter with the American City, observed the state of the building profession and asked rhetorically, how did a movement that began with a utopian social agenda at its heart become the architecture of corporate capitalism and facilitate the destruction of vital city neighborhoods under the banner of urban renewal? So here I want to suggest that the hypermodernist aspiration to novelty serves well a contemporary culture increasingly this-worldly, secular, pragmatic, utilitarian, contractual, virtual, therapeutic, somewhat hedonistic, and, but for the harsh opprobrium delivered swiftly by Twitter to persons who hold wrong opinions, effectively amoral. But hypermodernist light urbanism is not so light in its consequences. Especially in Western capitals of capital, and in today's exploding cities of the global South, hypermodernism both embodies and seeks to legitimate, in Philip Reeve's succinct but apt formulation, the freedom of hypermodern individuals to live an experimental life in the context of a consumer-oriented global economy. In the hypermodernist universe of discourse, the only moral qualification to the primary themes of consumerism and aesthetic innovation are professions of environmental concern. But even this gesture toward a moral ideal is unconvincing, because high-profile hypermodern architecture and urbanism depends so much on modern global industrial methods of manufacturing and transport of materials that, taken all together, are of dubious long-term economic and environmental sustainability. A final thought about today's hypermodernism. Just as both pre-modern urbanism and modernist urbanism have their own respective and opposite spatial features, spatial conditions and anti-spatial conditions, respectively, that is, pre-modern conditions, urban conditions are spatial, modern urban conditions are anti-spatial, respectively, but I can't go here into depth in these definitions again. Maybe afterwards we can talk about it. But just as pre-modern urbanism and modernist urbanism have their own respective and opposite spatial features, so too does hypermodernist urbanism have its unique spatial feature, junk space. The extensive, often low-ceilinged, anonymous environs of airports, hotels, subways, and shopping malls everywhere in the developed and developing world. What Kuhlhaas has called the, quote, new, flamboyant, flexible, forgettable face of architecture. Junk space is the residue mankind leaves on the planet. Junk space is what remains after modernization has run its course, or more precisely, what coagulates while modernization is in progress, its fallout. Modernization had a rational program to share the blessings of science universally. Junk space is its apotheosis or meltdown, end quote. So moving back now into the recent history of transitional modernism, which, by the way, remains the default sensibility of our contemporaries, modernism. Nevertheless, modernism is dead, and we have killed it. Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying modernism? Do we smell nothing as yet of the modernist decomposition? What, after all, are our new suburban office park buildings, medical complexes, mega stadiums, secure metal-detected high schools, unaffordable urban high-rise condos, and unintelligible urban sculptures? What are these but the tombs and sepulchres of the modernist utopia? How shall we comfort ourselves? Who will remove the homeless from our streets? Where shall we shop together? Perhaps I'm speaking too soon. Perhaps this anticlimactic event is still on its way. Okay, again, looking back to the history of late transitional modernism, the modernist rational program, of which Kuhlhaas speaks, differs from today's hypermodernism precisely in modernism's utopian and hence teleological character. The unflattering story of modernism I am telling, which of course is also a story about ourselves, is the story of a secular socialist utopian ideal that devolved into the architecture and urbanism of global capital. What is worth noting, however, is how the telos of utopian modernism was both similar to and different from the pre-modern culture of building that preceded it. Modernism burst on the scene in the first half of the 20th century, the almost mathematically precise architectural and urban equivalent of the French Revolution. And modernism succeeded in large part because it gave built expression to a secular gospel at a moment of acute cultural crisis in the aftermath of World War I. In the modernist telling, the Great War was a purging fire, and modernism's good news was one of progress, inevitability, scientific rationality, and the coming of a secular and imminent utopia. Banished, therefore, were the church and the town hall as the monumental buildings of the new modernist city, replaced by aggrandized electrical power plants, workers' housing, and office buildings. Where pre-modern building culture was hereditary and organic, modernism would be rational. Where pre-modern, and I'll just say Cartesian rationality, I'll qualify that, because I don't want to say that that pre-modern building culture was irrational, but modernism would be rational in a Cartesian way. Where pre-modern building culture was ornate, modernism would be spare. Where pre-modern building culture was corrupt, modernism would be pure. Where pre-modern building culture served princes and popes, modernism would serve the people. Nevertheless, for all but the most innocent modernist fellow travelers, modernist architecture was never so much about function as about aesthetics and the alleged formal design imperatives of modernity, with the language of function used as a club to batter the supposedly decadent pre-modern European building culture that preceded it. "A house is a machine for living in," wrote Le Corbusier, in an apparent endorsement of functional rationality. Yet few, if any, modernist masters were more concerned than Le Corbusier about developing an architectural aesthetic embodying the possibilities inherent in the building methods and materials of modern industrial production. Finally, looking even further back, what of the pre-modern building cultures displaced by modernism? One must say cultures, because a distinguishing characteristic of pre-modern building culture, of pre-modern building cultures, is that they generally built with locally sourced and regionally distinct materials. Far less typically the case with either modernist or hypermodernist building culture. And these materials, these locally sourced materials, in turn gave rise to distinctive local cultures of building. I should say, they gave rise to distinctive local cultures of building over time. But what else? These pre-modern cultures of building, being pre-modern, preceded mechanical means of transport. Hence, they were building cultures that produced walkable mixed-use settlements at a variety of densities as a spatial environment of blocks and streets and squares and foreground and background buildings. What else? Not least. Pre-modern cultures of building understood themselves to exist in a context of sacred order and intended both their cities and their sacred buildings as participants in and beautiful and ordered microcosms of an ordered universe, providing occasions for encounters with the sacred in a more or less enchanted world. I want to add a remark, not in my text, that is not a condition without ambiguities. But I just want to note that, but we can, again, that's something we can pick up later if you care to. So prior to the advent of modernity, these walkable mixed-use settlements of building and spatial hierarchies were forms of integralist human cultures, Christian and non-Christian, Western and non-Western, including the building culture that made Notre Dame de Paris. I will return to Notre Dame shortly. But as an example of a more or less intact collection of pre-modern buildings and spaces spanning across more than 700 years, I want to show you 10 illustrations of Bruges, Belgium, that will convey the integral character of a very good pre-modern small city culture of building. So watch the screen. somehow I didn't get the captions. If I reduce the size on this, will the captions show up? Oh, bingo, thank you. These things, will it do that? Will it consistently do that? Okay, so.
Should I just click through like
now? Yeah, sure. So, anyway, so market, this is a market square condition in Bruges. We're looking at a variety of public spaces, a variety of public buildings, background buildings, foreground buildings, how the foreground buildings terminate streets, just as an example of the culture of pre-modern architecture and urbanism. So, church fronting a Bruges neighborhood, public square from inside and outside. Churches, neighborhood churches terminating street vistas. The Béguinage, a medieval urban monastic quarter. The interior green of the Béguinage with the church and the residences. The old St. John's Hospital from the 12th century, which is now the Memling Museum. The students here are in more or less the same position as the painting in the lower right, and you can recognize the structure and its continuity. One of dozens of Bruges' centuries-old almshouses that are still in use today, and this is the exterior of one of those complexes, and this is the interior. And then the presence throughout the city of Madonnas. There are like 400 statues in like 2 square miles of statues of Our Lady throughout the city. So this one is a kind of plain one, and this one is a kind of fancy one. Okay, now I have some friends, possibly even some enemies, who are aspiring integralists of one sort or another. Catholic integralists, intersectional integralists, maybe other sorts. Does the fact that pre-modern cultures of building were, with rare exceptions, integral in their social character mean that pre-modern building cultures cannot exist in liberal societies? I think that depends on which liberalism, which set of Enlightenment ideals we're talking about, and that's yet another large subject that I don't have time to pursue today. Nevertheless, having shown 10 slides of integralist Bruges, and I must note that neither Bruges nor most any part of Belgium nor of Europe remain an integralist culture. The churches I showed are today largely empty but for tourists. But having shown slides of integralist Bruges, I do want to quickly show some slides of liberal America that nevertheless, and I mean liberal in the Enlightenment sense, that nevertheless evince many of the formal features of pre-modern cultures of building, particularly with respect to the monumentalization of religious and civic buildings in an urban spatial context. So this is America. So this is Williamsburg, Virginia. There's a single state church located at a main crossroads in a capital city, 17th century capital city. This is New Haven, Connecticut, founded in 1638, is a 9-square grid, a kind of model of the heavenly city, of the heavenly, the heavenly Jerusalem. It's the city itself as a kind of microcosm New Orleans, Louisiana, laid out in somewhat the manner of, really in the manner of, the laws of the Indies, even though it's not in South America, but a single church fronting a public square with a very formal disposition. Savannah, Georgia, founded in 1733, polycentric, plural, multiple churches on multiple squares, formally and informally disposed, but an example of religious pluralism that also allows for public and civic, religious and civic hierarchies. More Savannah, Georgia. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 1682, a polycentric, formal, cosmographic plan, with a political center but no designated place for churches, note well, founded by Quakers. So it's not just the plan with the city hall in the center, but it's also the squares distributed around. Actually, you can't see that when I'm pointing at my screen, can you? Anyway, let your eyes feast. And then the way in which religious buildings sort of congregate in sort of a hierarchical way, even informally in places that are not formally designed. So that this is an example. This is Port Gibson, Mississippi, on Highway 61 between Natchez and Baton Rouge, in which there are seven or eight churches that are located, you know, the red things on Highway 61 as it goes through the town. So it becomes a kind of de facto church street. And then Washington, D.C., which we think of as an entirely secular thing, and in terms of its formal order, it is. But so if you look at this layout of the primary organization of D.C., this is aerial view, old and new plans from 1901 and the L'Enfant plan from 1791. So you've got today the main east-west axis from the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial, and the north-south axis from the White House to the Jefferson Memorial. You've got that civic, these civic axes and cross-axes. But then what you have is actually an extension to the north up 16th Street, where you have located about 30 religious buildings in the next 4 miles along 16th Street, along that axis, along, running on the same axis as the White House. Now, you know, some of this is just, I mean, I think maybe you saw my note about the first law of architecture, that it reflects power and aspires to legitimate authority. So, you know, there's something to this idea of all these churches that are, you know, lining up on that street, you know, to have access to civic authority, maybe. But it also, I think, reflects this, the way in which we, again, in pre-modern traditional formal order of cities, you have registered the presence of religious buildings in a formal kind of way. Okay, finally, some concluding remarks about the future of Notre Dame de Paris in the kind of world where pre-modern Notre Dame confronts secular hypermodernity in the aftermath of a near catastrophic fire. I have not to this point said much about the subject of beauty, but before I show you one more glimpse of the many, many schematic design proposals for rebuilding Notre Dame that Stephen showed us, I have fewer. I remind you that Thomas Aquinas was walking around the streets of Paris while Notre Dame de Paris was under construction. And he had a few ideas about beauty that I'm certain were more shared than idiosyncratic in the Paris of his day, even if no one else in Paris could articulate those ideas quite so well. So if I may paraphrase some of Thomas's thoughts about beauty, at the risk of great embarrassment, given that this is a Dominican-sponsored event, here are some thoughts about beauty gleaned from St. Thomas and others. So I'm protecting myself here. So that beauty is an objective quality of the beautiful object, that our encounters with beauty please us immediately, that we understand that beautiful things are well made. Is this a tautology? Yeah. But were things not well made, we would not find them beautiful. That beautiful things both embody, and actually I want to say, this is why I think the design of church buildings actually is important, because it needs to be made well. If it's not made well, it reflects badly on the community, and, you know, it reflects, how do you reflect badly on God? I guess by not building well is one way. That beautiful things both embody clearly and reveal the essence of the things they are, that beautiful things appear to us complete. We don't seek to change them, and any alteration would be for the worse. That beauty attracts us, makes us grateful, judges us, changes us, elevates us, makes us want to be better. That beauty is not something we experience apart from nature or in contradiction to nature. Rather, beauty supervenes upon nature, which is why, I think, it is properly regarded as a transcendental, along with goodness and truth. Now, that said, if I'm anywhere near St. Thomas's intellectual ballpark, I'm certain that this is not the view of beauty shared by today's modernist and hypermodernist architects that has been discussed earlier in our gathering. So let's take a quick look at a few of their public submissions for the rebuilding of Notre Dame, which I hope will be at least a little more intelligible in light of the distinctions I've tried to make between pre-modern, modern, and hypermodern building culture sensibilities. So these first two, this one, this is the one that is the closest to what looks like just a restoration, except that both this one and, interestingly, Norman Foster's, which is this one, which is, I think, remarkably modest for Norman Foster. They're the ones that, like I say, are the least obtrusive, radical, problematic. But they do something very strange, which is that they're trying to put light at the top that's undifferentiated, which would entail removing the stone vaulting on the interior of the church, which is really what saved a lot of the interior of the church, that the stone vaulting held up pretty well, except for where the spire crashed through. And that's where all the interior damage was caused. So I think that that's a kind of problematic thing. But then they get worse. So we have several that are these kind of greenhouse things, which is, reflective of the kind of environmental... let's see. We need to be good stewards, but there is a kind of environmental... what's the word I want? It's not naivete. It's a sentimentality, I think, about environmentalism. So I know rocks at me maybe, but you have these greenhouse ones, right? So you got one with a fancy roof, and then you've got one that's pretty straightforward, and then this one's great because it's got a laser or something. but the little description of it too is great because they talk about it's like a home for butterflies and birds and bees. So it's an aviary as well as a greenhouse, and then this one. So I assume this is a laser thing, and that it's supposed to, it's going up. But somebody, the comment was that somebody made about it was, oh look, the Milky Way is pouring milk on Notre Dame. So I couldn't make that up. And then this one that sort of employs the idea of stained glass, sort of takes it to a way that stained glass arguably is not made to go. And then this one with the flames, the sort of monumentalization in gold of the last image of flames. And then this one, which I looked at this and I thought, oh, wow, it's like the Cubs World Championships trophy from 2016, but not as good. So I'm sorry, I'm being flippant. In pondering the challenge of engaging a building not simply old and venerable, but sacred, and again, time constraints prevent me from pursuing at length here my sense of the call and response character of life lived in orientation to the sacred, which I have alluded to already, I found myself turning to two brief passages from two brilliant theologian scholars recently in the last 15 years. The celebrated Yale church historian Yaroslav Pelikan, a Lutheran of Slovak and Serbian descent who late in life converted, or rather, as he said, reverted, to Eastern Orthodoxy, was invited to give the 1983 National Endowment for the Humanities Jefferson Lectures, which became the basis for the slim but graceful four-chapter volume later published under the title The Vindication of Tradition. In the third chapter of that book, Pelikan writes of the modern historian's disposition, which is to say his own guild's historically situated disposition, to study history in terms of historical discontinuities and change, and the external influences thereon. But then he notes that this approach to understanding history does not exhaust true understanding. He continues, and I quote, "Meanwhile, the evidences for historical continuity, for what might be called non-environmental factors, have tended to receive far less attention in the scholarly literature. I've never seen it stated in print, and I'm not quite sure just how I would go about documenting it, but it is, I think, a self-evident truth," is a reference to the Jefferson lectures, "that for more than 19 centuries and in a great variety of cultures, Christians have been blessing bread and wine and celebrating the sacrament of the Eucharist nearly every day. If that is a self-evident truth, it's also a massive instance of continuity amid change and a prime instance of the reality of tradition. It is as well the sort of phenomenon that the anthropologist, rather than the historian of ideas, would describe. The historian of ideas would study the permutations of language and thought by which successive generations have sought to come to terms with the practice. Those permutations may truly be said to reflect change rather than chiefly continuity, as becomes obvious when the proponents of a particular theory of the Eucharist, of Eucharistic presence, have sought to read it back into the texts of an early period. But the changes, in theory, were attempts to make sense of a continuing practice. And even in purely historical terms, whatever that may mean, do not themselves make sense apart from the continuing practice. When I said mutatis mutandis, that's germane, I think, to what we're thinking about in terms of the architecture. But if a historian looks only at the changes of Eucharistic theology, which is what most historians have done, the result will be a failure to do justice to the historical situation within which Eucharistic theology has evolved, which has been a situation of continuity and hence of tradition, end quote. Now, mindful that I think Pelikan was not denying either the fact of historical change or that in the providence of God, each present moment entails specific challenges to our shared human propensity to remember our past, to hope for our future, and to draw near to God, and that it is possible for human cultures both to discover truth and to lose it, what I want to ask is whether there might be analogs or analogies in Pelikan's characterization of the continuities of tradition for how we should think about sacred architecture, beauty, and our postmodern and post-Christian cultural moment. I think these concerns to be of great practical and existential import for both Christian and non-Christian religious communities, as well as the future of civil society. And so I want to conclude thinking with you about sacred architecture and sacred space under the rubric of Christian sacramentality. And then I'd like to share one more quotation from the late Jesuit theologian Edward Oakes, who, S.J., who in a letter published in the August 15th, 2003 issue of Commonweal magazine on the subject of modern church architecture wrote the following. This is a letter to the editor. Even the best modern church architecture seems too deliberate, too studied, too gimmicky to convince worshipers that the building in which they are worshiping is worshiping with them. And that's like an emphasis. I'm emphasizing this, for one thing, because it struck me as so strange, but more. He writes, in which they're worshiping, they can't convince worshipers that the building in which they're worshiping is worshiping with them, precisely because pre-modern builders were themselves worshipers. Hardly an assumption we can make today. For better, far better, it seems to me, to insist on returning to the past in neo-Gothic, neo-Romanesque, neo-Renaissance churches, much as that might seem a concession to the poverty of our age. Still, derivative art is better than bad, or at least gimmicky, art, end quote. Now, I want to say that this is not an unproblematic formulation. And because Father Oakes was an exceptionally smart person, I imagine that were he still alive, he would not be averse to greater precision. Nevertheless, there are some correct intuitions at work here with respect to building types and to sacramentality, intuitions that I myself recognized less clearly when I first read this letter. So I want to conclude with some images of pre-modern construction work that is being done and being proposed in the modern world very, very quickly. So the first three images are from the American College of the Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina, where they teach traditional building. So they teach like half a dozen different disciplines, but they teach, you can see they teach load-bearing masonry, they teach timber framing, and they teach stone carving. So obviously these would be germane to durable, they'd be, you know, pre-modern methods of construction with the help of some modern tools, of course. And then this last thing that I want to show is an unsolicited submission for the restoration of Notre Dame from three University of Notre Dame Architecture School graduates. It's essentially just this is all one drawing. It's that, right? It's one drawing. But the one drawing, what it illustrates is the restoration of the cathedral as it was. In the drawing in the middle, a proposal for a temporary church, basically a temporary basilican church plan. And then the third thing, shown on the right, but also shown here, is an on-site, workshop stage for the traditional artisans who would be doing the repairs. And I wanted to mention one. There is an organization in France called Les Compagnons du Devoir, the Companions of Duty. And apparently this is a centuries-old organization that's an apprenticeship where you learn these skills, and you take a tour through Europe, and you do 6 months in a place at a time, and over time you learn these skills. So they did their homework, I think, in sort of figuring out how this might be done in a traditional way. And as my colleague Steve Sim says, for considerably less, it would be considerably less than $1 billion to do this. Now, to enculturate a pre-modern culture of building in a hyper-modern culture seems to me to require a self-limiting culture of means. Self-limiting in terms of, one, what building materials and methods to use, and two, self-limiting in terms both of one's own and one's community's material needs. What in historic Christianity and other religious and secular communities as well is accurately regarded as an ascetic ideal. Not for its own sake, but rather for the sake of the spiritual freedom that comes from disciplining and limiting our own desires, an idea obviously difficult, if not repugnant, to a mass consumer culture. But that, it seems to me, is the only option available for persons interested, and it can be done in the world, but it seems to me it's the only option available for persons interested in relearning a tradition of making beautiful, durable architecture and urbanism offered to God in anticipation of God's presence in the work that is offered. The dilemma we face today with respect to our built environs and our natural and cultivated landscapes is that for too long we have been consumers of these things rather than makers and stewards of these things. Recovering a sense of stewardship and building as offerings that we make in anticipation of God's presence in what we offer is a long-term cultural project, although we do it at every Mass. It is long past time for us to begin that hard work of recovery and renewal. Left to our own devices, as we moderns are wont to insist, that may not be possible. But with God's amazing grace, perhaps it is. Thank you.